Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in on A Little Bit of Everything with me, and I am your host, Angelica. This is a podcast that talks about a little bit of everything, so sit back and enjoy the show. Everyone, and welcome back to another episode of A Little Bit of Everything with me. Today, my guest is a writer, producer, director of Wait, Wait, Don't Kill Me, a horror comedy that he recently completed about a viral pandemic in inner city Philadelphia. Welcome, Adam Lippi, to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Angelica.
Well, this is exciting. You created a film. You've wrote, produced, directed. You were a person of many hats with this film.
Yes, I was. I mean, it started out just as a script back in 2013 and finished the script in 2014. I didn't think I was going to direct it. I was a film critic in a former life, and it was sort of written as an experiment. But when I realized that no one else was going to make the film, I started out trying in 2014 in Philadelphia, trying to make the film. It didn't work out. And then I tried to make it in New York, where I was able to cast it. And I couldn't justify the financial cost of the locations in New York. So I ended up bringing the cast to Philadelphia and shooting the movie in 2015, ran out of money sort of in the middle of that, and came back in 2017. Did sporadic shooting throughout 2017, depending on how much money we had and how I could organize everything. And went into post-production starting in 2018, and that took a while. And we finished the viral pandemic movie the same weekend that the basically all of Pennsylvania was shut down.
Wow. So this is something that you've been planning years ago?
Yes.
And all of a sudden, it's like kind of happening, sort of say. Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. Like, it's crazy how this happened. But I want to go into this film of yours. Tell the listeners what it is about.
Sure. So it's about a virus that gets loose in inner city Philadelphia. It was shot in Germantown, which is in Philadelphia where I used to live. But it takes place mostly in Nicetown, which is right next to it. And it is called Nicetown. It is an unfortunately named place, but based on the level of crime, but that's what it is. Mm-hmm. So it takes place in Nicetown, and it's this virus gets loose, mysterious virus gets loose in Nicetown, and it causes massive dehydration. People start sweating out their insides, and because people are mostly water, they start attacking each other for their liquids. And one of the attacks is caught on a viral video, and it gets loose, obviously, and the military comes into a local hospital to try to stop everything as quickly as they can, maybe develop a vaccine or some way of stopping it. And they realize they can't do it quickly enough, so they just fence off the inner city of Nicetown and just let everybody die. And it's about the people who were left there. There's a lot of different characters. It's an ensemble piece of people who already have tougher lives than most of the time, most of the kind of people you might see in a viral pandemic movie, and then have to deal with this on top of it.
Yeah, and I'm actually looking at your trailer, and I'm just like, wow, there's so much happening. And how does this process start? Like, I know you mentioned you do the scripts and stuff, and you know, we see these movies being released, but how long did it take you to create all of this?
Well, the script took, I wrote throughout 2013, stopped and started, and then wrote a massive draft that was finished early 2014. That was about 140 pages or so. And normally you're supposed to think of it as a page a minute. And a movie like this, which is both a combination of like a serious subject, but treated sometimes in an absurd way. You think a page a minute, but you can't have a movie like this be 2.5 hours, which would be 140. I think it was like 142 pages was the first draft. So I kept paring it down, and you take out all the big things, like, cause I didn't think I was going to direct the movie. I just went enormous. Like, it reads as a $15 million movie, and it, trust me, it didn't cost anywhere near that. And I just kept taking out big action sequences and big, horrific deaths and all sorts of things like that. and focus more on the characters. And so most of the dialogue remained the same from the first draft to the shooting draft, which was about 99 pages. And the movie runs 102 minutes. So I've kind of gotten that page a minute thing exactly right, even though it's very densely packed with incident and information. And, you know, if anything, it'll be sort of a lot for anybody watching it, I think, because they'll maybe relate to some of it, and then maybe they find some of it off-putting. It really depends on the person, because you don't have to only like horror comedies, because it is subversive at times, but it also is silly. There's animation in it. There's it's never self-aware. I was very conscious of never breaking the fourth wall, never drawing attention to the fact that you're watching a movie, but it gets close to that.
Mm-hmm. And when writing the script and the story, like, have you ever had those doubts of like, oh, am I moving into this the right direction? Like, have you felt like you ever given up? Because, you know, I truly don't know much about the film industry. So I wanted to hear your journey of creating this.
Oh, well, there are hundreds of reasons to give up while you're making it, because especially because I ran out of money in the middle, and, you know, the personal calamity of it. And then the notion of not finishing it was a horrible nightmare. But yeah, there were any sensible person would have stopped making it. But in the 18 months between one shooting day and another, which is a ridiculously long time to then bring back the same cast and shoot, and then try to sometimes take different pieces of scenes that were shot one piece in 2015 and then one piece in 2017. And then sometimes some of those actors may not be available that day. So you have a double. And then sometimes there's doubles there's two different doubles in the same scene. And you know, all I had to do was, okay, make sure the height was right. And so, yeah, there were tons of reasons to not finish the movie. And it was just a matter of, I knew I would regret it. And whatever toll it took on my health, both physically and mentally, and in my pocketbook, I guess it was worth it, because it just seemed to be an awful thing not to get that far into it and not finish it, because you would hate yourself, and you would, this never was about money for me anyway, or glory or anything. It was just, you know, how can I look at myself in the mirror if I went through all of this stuff and kept fighting all of these battles? Because that's all it is when you make a movie, it's just fighting one, you know, contracts, or, you know, getting past a problem that you couldn't have foreseen, or crew problem, whatever it is, it's a constant. And, you know, you'll have, you know, 5,000 things that get in your way, and you're like, well, this would be a good time to stop. Well, this person's not available. How do I get around this problem? And you just keep going until it's finished. And, you know, it's not even that it's in the rearview mirror, because once it's finished, which was finished in March, like, it's another battle within distribution. So there's all sorts of reasons to never continue doing it and just be like, all right, well, this part's finished, I should be satisfied with that. But yeah, it's a matter of just continuing to push through, even if you were trying to describe what you were doing to another person, they would tell you to stop because it wasn't sensible. You just have to fight past that.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that, because to me, sitting here listening to you, I'm just like, oh my gosh. Like, you know, we don't see the behind the scenes of what it took to create a storyline, to hire these characters, the scheduling, everything. We don't really see much of that. And that's what I like. Believe it or not, when I watch a movie, I could care less more about the movie. I'm actually interested in what happened behind the scenes, like the takes, the falls, and what they had to, you know, director's commentary, where it's just like, wow, okay, damn, like, you know, this person had a hard time with this, and they had to hire this and hire that. That's like what I'm so interested about mostly when it comes to these movies. But wow, thank you for sharing that, because to me, I'm like, I still don't know, like, what is the behind the scenes here?
Well, someone has encouraged me, oh, you should write a book about the making of the movie, because it was this lengthy disaster of a thing. And then you also learn, because it was such a long break in between shooting days, it was basically like making two movies at once. Wow. Like, I started in 2015, and then I learned all these lessons, but I couldn't afford a big crew anymore. Mm-hmm. So then the last 5 days in 2017, which were spread out over 8 months, were very pared down, and they required a lot of planning. And it was completely overstuffed schedules, shooting tons and tons of sequences or doing something terribly complex, and just trying to get everything in place. And it would just be, you know, me and a producer in a room planning it, and then me making calls and getting the, you know, getting all the paperwork done. I mean, there were shooting days. There's one in particular, and I realize you don't know a ton about the filmmaking industry, but I mean, what I'm describing to you is unusual, to say the least, where we had a day where it was 18 sequences shot on 10 different locations in under 12 hours with people from coming in from four different states with about 15 different actors. And you know, whenever you have to go from location to location, it takes time because you've got to get everyone a vehicle and then go somewhere else and then set up. And then you've got a crew. And so the crew was just me, two camera people, a sound man, and a driver taking people back and forth through the bus station, because I would buy bus tickets for the cast who would have to go back home to New York in between takes. And then someone would drive them right back to where they had to go. And then there were other parts of that same day where we go in the basement where a lot of the movie takes place, or at least about 40 minutes of it, and record what's called ADR, which is additional dialogue recording, which is some off-screen dialogue that you hear. In a different, you know, and that's going on while the set is being lit upstairs by the two camera guys. And so I'm in the basement with the sound guy and the actors, and I've written out a script of what I need them to say. And then they say it. And then all of that ends up in the movie, in the midst of this day where you're, you know, going from location, like the notion of doing more than one location in a day on a big budget movie just does not happen. So the notion of doing 10 in under 12 hours and then worrying about all these things where I'm functioning as writer, producer, director, script supervisor, assistant camera, assistant director, property master, lunch orderer, bus ticket orderer, all while trying to focus and remain and also direct the actors and tell them, okay, I need this here. And then also have everybody fill out the paperwork that you have to have. Cause some of these people you'll never see again. In fact, most of them you'll never see again, you know, extras or actors who are on their last day, or actors are only going to be there one day. And then make sure that the, you know, is this working? Like, how's the sound here? Do I have the props in place? You know, are we focused? What's the shot you need? You know, that kind of thing. So it becomes a huge undertaking. And you'd think, well, that day was probably lost, right? Mm-hmm. No, I mean, most of it is in the movie. The stuff that was necessary ended up in the movie. Pretty much as I had pictured it from the day. And when you prepare that much, it means when things get behind, and they inevitably will get behind. I mean, I remember that day very specifically because the bus coming in from New York with some of the main actors was running an hour late. And I had already penciled in that they would take an hour to go from the bus station to the set, but then it was running another hour late. And so I had to change everything around. So then we fall behind and I've got to move which sequence we're shooting. And then say, okay, and make phone calls in between takes and go, all right, we're going to have to be here to show up here. You know, this place has to be open, you know, when we're allowed on this location to do this. And then this scene, which was intended to be shot at dusk, is now going to be during at night. And then, okay, how do we adjust that? And, you know, all these different things. And I realize I'm talking in a storm here, but you in the latter half of the shooting days, it was stuff like that would cause, you know, unprepared people to have a breakdown. And I remember snapping only once at a cameraman guy, and I did apologize, but because I was just under such pressure, it becomes overwhelming, and the levels of stress that you're like, okay, what do I do here? Well, and you're never on autopilot, but you just are so worn down. I think it took me like, you know, 2 days to kind of sleep it off after that.
Wow. And I really, really appreciate you sharing this whole entire process for me, because really I'm not familiar with the film industry and I don't watch many movies because I'm very particular which ones I watch, but I'm just like blown away of what it takes, because I'm being serious, like you really don't see much of it even in the special.
Oh no, this is, I'm giving you the what I'm telling you is sort of the warts and all version, but I'm giving you the watered down version. Like it's actually worse. It's actually worse than what I'm saying. But you know, for all sorts of reasons, you never get into completely the nitty gritty and all the arguments you have and you don't say something bad about someone if it did hurt the film, you don't do that.
Yeah.
So no, I'm giving you the sort of thing that would, even the description that I'm giving you would never get through a PR person at all.
Yeah.
They would say, oh no, it all went smoothly. It was wonderful. And I would say, well, when I was a film critic, I would want to hear what I just said So I would say it.
Yeah. Understandable.
So, no, generally, things either move smoothly when you have money, things move a lot smoothly because you can throw money at problems.
Yeah, exactly.
But if I have, you know, and I'll just throw out a number that's not inaccurate, but is not totally accurate because I don't remember the budget for that specific day because it's not in front of me. But let's just say I did that whole day for $2,000. Mm-hmm. That's probably in the ballpark. You know, $2,000 is about, you know, 15 seconds on a major feature. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean 15 seconds of footage. I mean, 15 seconds of time spent on the set. So mm-hmm. I did all of that stuff for that range of price. I'm throwing that number out there, even though it's, you know, vague. But yeah, at the same time, I had to put blood on somebody's hand that day. So fake blood. So I guess I was sort of the makeup person, but not in any real sense. Like the makeup in the movie is really good. And I did not contribute except to put blood on somebody's hand. I did not take a makeup credit, nor do I deserve one. But the point is, yeah, you wouldn't hear about this stuff because people would never think that you should ever do business this way. And it's not like I regret it at all or talking about it in that way, because there are plenty of times where you have to, you know, make quick decisions. And the only way to get through it is to have lots and lots of meetings. And if you can't do that because you don't have the time, it's just, all right, I'm going to trust my instincts. Oh, well, I can't do that because it's got too much planning. Yeah, it just comes out. I'm just great. I'll say it this way. I'm just grateful that the footage is palatable in the movie and nobody will ever know which scenes are which mm-hmm. scenes were shot in such a rushed manner.
Wow. And through this whole journey of the filming and all of that, how were you, I know it could be a lot of stress, but how did you be able to control that? Because like, I can imagine like you're running back and forth, you're trying to make sure everything's good and it's looking great. How did you manage that?
In those situations, so I process stress differently. Mm-hmm. Although I do have acid reflux, which is, I don't show it a lot. It's not really visible. Mm. It'll come out later, maybe privately, mm-hmm. but in pressure, I'm good in pressure situations. I've always sort of been designed like that. So that doesn't really bother me. I don't know if that's quite what you were looking for. Do you want me to rephrase that to say it was the worst time of my life?
No.
I hated every second. I have no more nails. I bit right through them. In fact, I don't even have fingers anymore.
No.
I'm talking to you through stubs. That's how I typed in my password.
No, I definitely appreciate that because it's interesting how people manage their stress level and the fact that you work better under pressure. It seems like, you know, you were able to handle it pretty well during those situations. And, you know, I always like to hear how people, because you learn from other people, especially working under pressure. That's like a huge thing with a lot of people nowadays, right? So
sure.
I'm glad you were able to, you know, just, hey, you know, let's just finish this day off. And then when I got home, I'm just going to decompress.
Yeah. And it would probably help, but I don't drink or do drugs. So it probably would have helped, but I don't. not out of some, you know, need to not do it. It's just, you know, I had my time in my early 20s mostly. So, you know, I just don't have the urge anymore. It doesn't interest me. So I don't, you know, maybe that would have been a way to relax. I don't smoke, you know, so that would have been probably a healthy / unhealthy way to deal with the stress.
Yeah, for some people it could work for them, and I'm just like, yeah, okay, maybe I might consider, maybe not, but no.
I mean, a lot of this is also learning how to manage like hundreds of people.
That's a lot.
Because it was long time frames in between mm-hmm. when we started shooting and when we finished shooting. There's different people on the crew, and then post production is its own thing with an entirely different set of people, where you then got to interview editors and interview people who do the special effects and negotiate prices. and do it, you know, same thing with a sound designer and a composer and each piece, and then have days where you're like bringing and interview all the people who you're going to go into a booth with for additional dialogue recording, and then bring in the actors again who you haven't seen in years, and they're going to show up and re-record all their dialogue, and you've got to plan all that out and get all the files and learn all the software. Even though I wasn't editing the movie, and then know what to do, and then just keep track of like hundreds of things, because eventually at the end, it's just me dealing with the finances and the, you know, and how the movie ends up. And, you know, eventually you just kind of let it go. Like, I can't do anything more with this. Could I cut more out of the movie? Probably, but I wouldn't want to.
Now, once the film was done and you finished everything, what's that process like? Because I know you mentioned at the beginning, like you're working with people to release this film and stuff. So how does that work?
Well, I'll say, you know, right as of the moment of our record, I'm gonna break the rule just a little bit. As the movie was released on Friday via the Colonial Theater, which is near to me, and it's not playing in the theater, it's playing virtual screening. So you would go to their website, and then they have a section for all of their sort of independent and art films. And my film is underneath there, next to legitimate documentaries about real people, which is a very surreal experience to see. Oh, well, there's this, you know, my movie is next to this Korean drama and a documentary about John Lewis, and this movie about older people finding romance. And then there is my silly horror comedy about a viral pandemic. Oh, well, that's an odd juxtaposition. But and virtual screenings work in a way where you can watch it at home, and even though it's through the theater, and then they get their financial side of it. That's how our independent and art theaters have been staying in business during the pandemic. But distribution is probably the worst part of making a movie, especially if you're doing it on your own, because there's almost no way to make money. And I don't mean like to make money to a point where like it's you're thriving and you're living off of that money. I mean, there's almost no way to even gross, say, $5,000. So it's tipped in a way where they have cut off all the revenue sources, because there's no DVD and Blu-ray marketing for non-mainstream movies anymore. And their theatrical serves no purpose, and especially now during the pandemic, there's no real theatrical anyway. And streaming services, there's so many of them, that the revenue that you get from is minimal. So even something like Amazon Prime has been paying 1 cent an hour for films. So if somebody watches my hour and 42 minute movie, I would end up with 1.67 cents or so. And if I went through a distributor, and the distributor deals are often weighed to a point where, and you have to learn all of this when you're done, because distribution changes about once a year. Now it's changing even more frequently, and there's thousands of streaming services, most of which you've never heard of, and you don't know whether you're going to be ripped off by any of them. So you never want to sign exclusive deals, because you know you're then tied to that person or that company that may go out of business and may screw you over, and then you know they own your movie for say 15 years, and you have no piece of it. You have no recourse at all, and they might sell their business to and go bankrupt to some conglomerate. And then again, like who, you know, you don't even know who you're dealing with anymore. And that's very common. So there are all these different platforms, and you have to learn about all of them. And some of them have lots of what's called deliverables. And I won't get too technical into this, but it's basically all the things that you have to do in order to deliver the movie to the distributor. Now the distributor is not paying you for the film. You're handing them the movie and it's all back end. There's no such thing as what's called a minimum guarantee for an independent film anymore. A minimum guarantee is we guarantee we will pay you this much. In other words, an upfront fee.
Yeah.
But they don't do that anymore, because their margins are so thin that they have just gotten rid of it. So unless your movie has a big star that they're like, oh, we can absolutely sell this overseas, then they will pay you, you know, they won't pay you a minimum guarantee. And of course, if you had a big star, it wouldn't be an independent movie truly, would it? Because that person would have cost a lot of money. So, and that movie was probably pre-sold before it was even made based on the name of the star. So you wouldn't have to go through most of these problems. Slow me down if I'm talking too much and too much in a circle here. Basically you go through, you figure out all these distributors, and most of the deals are completely lopsided, and you can negotiate them all you want. And I do that, but you're only going to get so far. Because their margins are so thin. So they'll have things like you have to all these deliverables. You've got to spend probably, if you want to get full access to the entire world, you'll probably have to spend, even on a fiction film. Documentaries cost more, actually, but on a fiction film, somewhere in the neighborhood of $8,000 to $10,000 just to hand the movie over to the distributor. And there's no guarantee that they're going to get any of that back. So, because it's all these legal things and all of these title change, you know, title, copyright, mm-hmm. different kinds of insurance, all sorts of things. And the list is long. And they'll also make you make trailers for them, make a poster, and you're going to have to pay for all your own marketing, because they're not going to market your film for you, because they can't do that. They can't afford to do that. What they want to do is build up their catalog. So they'll own, like, you know, 500 movies, and they'll sell 20 of them to one country at a time. And then, you know, $2,000 they might get for those 20 movies, and they'll split that $2,000 between the 20 filmmakers. But they're not really splitting it between the 20 filmmakers, because the deal that they make has what's called a marketing minimum in it. They all have these kinds of deals, pretty much. Very few don't. And the marketing minimum is the minimum amount that they say they're going to spend on marketing, but really, like, how much time are they spending selling your film? And so before, say your marketing minimum, this is pretty normal, is $10,000. Mm-hmm. You have to reach that $10,000 before you even, of revenue, before you even get to whatever the split is in the agreement. So even if my split is 70-30 in my favor, I've got to surpass the $10,000 to even get to the 70-30 split. So if they sold these 20 movies for $2,000 and my side is $100, I'm still well under that $10,000. So I'm never seeing any of it. I realize, wow, again, that's a lot of information all at once, but I'm trying to, but this is how this works now.
Yeah.
And so the way that I devised it was to just never sign exclusive deals, just sign lots and lots of non-exclusive ones. And so if most of them don't work out, then it doesn't bother me, because I still own the rights, as opposed mm-hmm. to sign with one company and you don't know what's going to happen. And then, you know, oh no, you know, years later, I am mad because I don't own my movie. I can't do anything with it. Or worse, someone in my movie got famous and now someone else owns it and they can exploit it, and I'm never seeing a cent of it because I can't prove that they earned anything.
Yeah. No, I appreciate all this information. I really do. Now, to go backtrack a little bit, mm-hmm. What inspired you to create this film?
I had a conversation with someone in 2013 where they were like, I want to make a zombie movie. And I said, well, you know, everyone makes zombie movies. Why wouldn't you just make a virus movie instead, where you can make up your own rules about what the virus does and how people react to it? And he thought, I don't want to do that. And then I don't remember speaking to him much after that point. And I just went and wrote it. And just came up with, because I was a film critic for so long, there were so many, I had seen thousands of horror films, and and I was been a big horror fan. So I'd seen every conceivable way that someone had died in a movie, so I started writing down the ways that I had not seen people die in a movie.
Yeah.
And I just wrote those down. And the first, I wrote down 60 ways I'd never seen people die in a movie. And then the first draft had 39 of them. And I just, that's why that first draft was so bloated. Mm-hmm. And people would go, oh, you're worried about the deaths, that you're worried focused on that. What about the characters? I'm like, well, there's plenty of characters. That's why the thing is so long. Mm-hmm. So I thought what I would do is have all the carnage as a way to sneak in the political messages, the social commentary, you know, stuff about race and class, all that stuff that's still in the movie, and just hide it behind the horror film that it appears to be, even though it's mostly, I would say, a dark comedy with horror elements in it.
Wow. You've taken a risk on it, and of course you decided to follow what you wanted to do, and it's, you're going to have those people that are going to say, no, like, are you crazy? That's not going to be a good idea. And you see that everywhere in anything that anybody does, but isn't it awesome to proceed forward with what you wanted? And look at it now, like, you completed this project, now you're getting it out there. It's got to be a really awesome feeling.
It's a relief more than an awesome feeling, mm-hmm. to be honest, because at the same time, you're like, you still have the bug in you where you're like, oh, what's my next project? Well, right now you can't shoot anything anyway, so it doesn't matter. But I have other things that I want to shoot that are much smaller, and there wouldn't be, like, you know, in this case, Wait, Don't Kill Me is 40 locations, 45 speaking parts, 100 extras, which would normally be what you'd shoot, you know, like a big budget movie would have that. You wouldn't have a movie that, you know, that costs this little.
Yeah.
Be like that. But my next film that I want to shoot is one location mostly and three characters, in that same location. So you don't have to go anywhere. And then you're just dealing with the three people and it's a small enclosed set. So you control all the factors and it's more about the, you know, the characters at that point anyway. And so in essence, yeah, the whole thing is more of a relief to be finished. The point about naysayers, I mean, you're going to get those, but this will sound bad, but you have to realize that only your opinion is important. If you think it's a good idea, just keep going with it. If you're not breaking the law and you can afford it, I don't see the downside. I mean, movies are so cheap to make right now that even if you're the only person who ever sees it, you'll feel a sense of accomplishment. And plenty of people will tell you every idea you have is a bad idea. And it's not just about their fear and their projection. It's also their concern for what seems sensible and whatever you know time period you're shooting or planning the thing is. So it's not a matter of like, oh, they're just jealous. That may be a small part of it, but I don't think that's entirely it. I talked to plenty of people when trying to make the movie, because you end up dealing with four times as many people that actually worked on the movie. Like, you know, if say a couple hundred people worked on the movie, I probably dealt with about 1,000 different people, and you know, who didn't get hired or were part of false starts. And plenty of them had their woes and their tales of failed projects. And they would try to project that onto you, and you'd have to go, no, I'm just going to keep going. You know, I know that you're not necessarily deliberately trying to sabotage this. And then you'll get, you know, on your movie, you'll be like, is that person trying to sabotage and how do I get free of them? Or you won't know until later that they were being destructive for their own reasons. Yeah, you want to, if you think it's a good idea, there's no reason to just, you know, to stop, just keep pushing through. And if it's too harmful, then maybe just stop completely. But, you know, I'm not sensible like that. So.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think is next for you? I know we're going through a pandemic, and is this the time where you're trying to figure out what's the next film? What are you doing right now?
I know, you know, I have a regular job, but I know what the next film is. It's just that I can't shoot it because I don't know how you would insure anything that lasts more than one shooting day. Because if someone gets sick on your set, is the movie over?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I understand from reading they have COVID compliance officers, but they're not cheap. And, you know, you're going to have to add, you know, 30% to your budget just to deal with all these parameters now. You know, it used to be you just had like a table out with food on it. You can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to have everybody separate. I have no idea how any violent scenes or sex scenes are shot because where people have to touch each other, how exactly does that work? I don't, you know, the project I wanted to shoot next had violent sequences and sexual sequences. So I don't know how you do that. Will you use dummies? do you disinfect the dummies beforehand? I don't really know. Like if you have two people making out, how does that work?
Yeah.
I wrote another project in the meantime that could absolutely be shot during a pandemic, but and that acknowledges that the pandemic might go on for several years. It takes place in 2022 in sort of the fourth stage of the pandemic that we never got out of. Yeah, I just can't think of a way that you can shoot on consecutive days or within, you know, a couple of weeks and still protect yourself. Or if somebody does get sick outside of your set, then what do you do? You can't go, all right, you can't go to the supermarket while we're shooting this because you might catch something. I mean, I know that Tyler Perry was doing a thing where he was quarantining actors for 2 weeks before shooting. I don't know how that's progressed, but I mean, if you can afford it, great. But he has a compound, so of course he can afford it. He's got all the money. He's got his own basically studio. Mm-hmm. So the rest of us who can't afford stuff like that may just have to wait to build up more money to protect against the inevitable lawsuits when someone gets sick, or you know, the false starts that'll occur if you hire an actor and they suddenly get sick.
Yeah, and how do you see the future going with film now with all of this? Like, in the next 2 years, like it's going to change drastically. Cause you know, a lot of people, like you mentioned, like, how are we going to do these scenes? Like it's some of these scenes play important roles in part of the story.
Right. And you can't make a movie of Zoom calls.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to try. They already made those Unfriended movies years ago. And that's basically what that is. There's plenty of those movies like Open Windows where it's just like, you know, different screens, but nobody wants to sit through more than, you know, one of those a year. Mm-hmm. I don't honestly know. I think they're going to make a lot of movies overseas. I'm wondering the power of the American system in terms of the unions and such when all the productions are going to have to move overseas because we've mangled this response so badly. We're kind of half in, half out, which means we're completely stuck. There's no real straightforward answer to that because it's entirely unpredictable. I mean, I know that my film, you know, is seen as like, you know, prescient in a way because the characters, you know, do talk about things like, you know, hiding high death counts from the public, mm-hmm. Quarantines and, you know, all sorts of things that are currently going on. And so someone said to me, oh, well, tell you, you're an oracle. Tell me what's going to happen. I'm like, I just got it right by accident. You know, I'm just guessing. The other thing I wrote about sort of the quarantine, a separate project, is just guesses. Like, this is what I think it would look like in a couple of years if we're still stuck in this. Is it right? I don't know. So there's not a straightforward answer to that question because you can't predict where we are politically, where we are emotionally, whether the corporations that fund most of the major movies want to move forward on these things, if they think it's just easier to just take big tax write-offs on all the financial losses, whether we'll be with it employment-wise. Mm-hmm. It's entirely unpredictable. And I would assume very scary for someone whose job this is like, you know, 24/7. I mean, I've been on shows where someone who works in the industry is interviewing me and I'm, you know, I'm there promoting my film, but mostly I'm thinking about, I wonder what their situation is like, how they get through, you know, the uncertainty of all of this.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you should write a book with this film. What do you think?
It's a lot of work for a small audience. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. And, you know, there's all the legal gray areas. There's all the smack talking I want to avoid. Yeah. And, you know, what I can teach people how to do is how to navigate these problems. But then mm-hmm. there's all sorts of things that are kind of built into my personality that I can't teach anybody how to do. Mm-hmm. That you can't just do by force of nature or force of will that are I am designed in a particular way to not worry about these things at this time. And then, but also internalize all the problems and worry about how to do something 10 steps down the road. All I can say to people is, if you haven't already, learn to play chess, because it will help you plan, all sorts of your, you know, what to do with your life and prepare for the worst. And then when the worst doesn't quite happen, you don't think it's so bad.
Yeah. Well, Adam, thank you so much for all of this great information. Where can the listeners find you?
Well, so the movie, if this airs after it's not playing at the Colonial anymore, and maybe it's at a different theater, maybe it's on a different streaming service, you can go to waitwaitdontkillme.com. I'll keep that updated. You know, the Twitter, I think, is WWDKM, the film. There's a similar thing on Instagram. You know, if you're nice enough on Facebook, I'll engage with most people if you look under my name. You know, as you can probably tell from listening to me talk, I'm a lot of information. So mm-hmm. On almost any subject, I will probably talk to you to death. So if you found this exhausting and you would like a repeat, like you want to feel drawn and like you need a nap, go ahead, send me a message on Facebook. I'll probably look at it and I'll probably wear you out.
Well, thank you so much for all your time. And, you know, I really appreciate this for you sharing the behind the scenes. And also, I want to wish you all the success with this film that you have. And hopefully it can bring you some more opportunities and, you know, create this book. I want this book.
Well, it would be called How Not to Make a Movie.
Yeah. I definitely appreciate it. I really do.
Thank you, Angelica.
Well, to all my listeners, everything is going to be in the show notes for you. Thank you, Adam, once again. And thank you for listening. And that's all we have for now.
Hi, this is Michelle Miller from Mentors on the Mic podcast.
I'm Anthony.
And I'm Jessica with the Beautiful Feet podcast.
Hey, it's your boy Bromar, host of The Bromar Show.
Hello, everyone. It's the Coupon Queenpin from the CQP Moments podcast.
What's up, everybody? This is your boy Ken, aka The Gentleman of The Gentleman Lifestyle Podcast.
Hi, this is Stephanie Valente, your local massage therapist.
And you are listening to A Little Bit of Everything with Angelica.
That's it for now, and thank you for tuning in on another episode of A Little Bit of Everything with me. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Just don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on the podcast platform that you're listening to.